This is the Indie Dads Podcast. I'm Malcolm.
And I'm Brian.
And we're a couple of dads sharing our journey about starting out and bootstrapping our indie businesses while still prioritizing our young families. We believe that you can bootstrap a successful SaaS, freelance, or indie business while still enjoying the family life.
Join us as we share our learnings from building our businesses from scratch. Well, good morning.
Morning, Brian. Well, actually, afternoon. No, we're doing good.
We've got someone else here, too, I see.
Hello.
Third voice. We're excited.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So today we've got Aaron Francis with us. He's Aaron D. Francis on Twitter. He is the father of twins, which sounds exhausting to me. and I believe, Aaron, you're working full-time and building Hammerstone. Is that correct?
Yep, that's correct.
Okay. So indie parent, working full-time, building something on the side. From what I can gather, Hammerstone is a collection of Laravel libraries?
Yeah, primarily Laravel and Rails, but primarily Laravel at this point.
Okay. So the tagline from your website is that, you know, we focus on features everyone needs to have, but nobody wants to build. So that sounds interesting. We'll talk about that. You've also got your own podcast called the Hammerstone Podcast. You're like 40 plus episodes in.
Yeah, I think we've been doing it for almost a year and obviously missed a few. But yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Wow.
Cool.
How often do you guys release episodes?
The goal is once a week. So it's me, Sean, and Colleen, and those are my other two co-founders. And we basically, that's kind of the only time we talk every week. And so every week we'll get on and record, and then that's it.
What cool. do you guys generally talk about in terms of subject matter? Is it just about building Hammerstone?
Yeah, pretty much. So we will get on and talk about, so Colleen is full-time embedded at a client working on one of our components there. And so Yes. We'll catch up with her about what's going on over at the client. She's building it out. She's building out our component, which I can describe later. She's building it out in Rails. And Sean is our front-end guy. And we've recently hired two contractors. So there's a lot to, catch each other up on. And I'm living in the Laravel world that they're not in and working on a lot of open source stuff. And so I catch them up on that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's kind of just a status meeting, really.
And you sometimes have guests on your Hammerstone podcast. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, you had Matt Wensing on.
I did, yeah.
And you kind of talked to him about some of the same topics that we like to talk about, which is, doing this as a parent.
So Sean and Colleen were out that week, and I had been kind of DMing with Matt a little bit, and something that had been on my mind, I have, like you mentioned, I have twins and they're 8 months old, and I'm trying to do this stuff on the side and work a full-time job and be a parent. And, Matt, for those, I'm sure y'all know, but other people, Matt has exited a company before, and he's got, I believe, four kids, including twins. I think he's got 11-year-old twins. Wow. And so I wanted to talk to him about, like, how do you balance this, and how do you know? Because right now I'm working all the time, and the goal is to work all the time now, so that when the kids are, 3, 4, 5, I'm not mm-hmm. working all the time. But it only makes sense if it pays off. And like, if it doesn't pay off, I would have been better just, cutting out at 5 o'clock and going inside to dork around. So that's kind of the thing I'm trying to work through right now. And I know y'all's kids, I think, are older than mine. So I'd be curious to talk about that as well from y'all's perspective.
Well, that was a really good episode. And we'll include it in the show notes. I think it's worth anybody that's listening in to Indie Dads to go over and give it that a listen. But what was your main takeaway from that, Aaron? If you could just give it a summary on what you got taking away from that conversation with Matt.
Yeah. So one of my main takeaways was, we, as working people, we tend to think that the amount of time spent on something, the amount of input will, equate or affect the amount of output. And Matt was really good about saying, like, if you can spend 1 hour working on something at work, that may be all you need to do for that like period of time. But when it comes to family, like it's not the same way. What they want is time, not effectiveness. So like if you can be super effective at work, it doesn't really matter how much time you've put in. But if you give like your kid four solid pushes on the swing, they're not going to say, wow, that those pushes were really effective. Thanks for doing that, Dad. They'd be like, no, push me some more and let's go dig up worms for 4 hours. And it's like, those two things are totally separate. And it was helpful for me to understand that in work, I can be super effective with short time and I need to try to do that more. And in family, it's all about time put in. And that's helpful for me while they're so young, so I can frame that going forward.
Yeah. And I think there's also an aspect of quality, because I don't know if you guys found this, but when I first started out and, you know, being so passionate about the side project and, you know, dreaming of where it's going, you know, I'd be sitting at the dinner table and I'm spending time with my family, but I'm not there. And my wife knows me really well. We've been married for almost 20 years now, and she just takes one look at me and says, "Malcolm, you're not here." That's like a big thing that I've had to learn, is to be present when I'm spending time with the family. Because I, you know, it used to be just a tick box. Well, I'm not in front of my desk, in front of my computer, so technically I'm not working. But there's that mental switch as well, which takes, I guess, some practice.
How old are yours?
So my kids are 10, 11, and 14. And Brian, yours?
Okay, I've got to go through. I've got five, so I've got to try to get this right. We've got
it takes a little 17 bit more thinking.
17-year-old about to graduate from high school, which is really, really weird. I've got a 15-and-a-half-year-old about to start driving, also weird. A 13-year-old, a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old. I guess that's everyone. I thought I missed someone there for a second. Yeah, that's five. I can name them easier than I can give you their ages.
Sure.
But it's pretty crazy. And you know, they always say that it passes by really quickly. And I was always like, yeah, whatever. But now, you know, my almost 18-year-old's off doing her extracurricular things. You know, she's super into dance. My son's always hanging out with his friends, you know, so it's like, man, it really does fly by. And it's hard, because the reason we're doing this is for them. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the reason we want this time independence, location, financial independence. But it's that balance. And you know, some people are totally cool with working full time forever and doing the traditional, you know, 40 years and you retire. But there's something, for some reason, in some of us that just drives us to want to do this. So for you, Aaron, like what is it? Why aren't you content to just work a full time job? What is it that drives you, that makes you want to do this, other than, you know, having a better life for your family eventually? I think that's what we all want. What is it that kind of got you started? How's
that
it going?
That is the question, isn't it? Because I talk to, you know, obviously my wife and I talk about this a lot, and especially over Thanksgiving break, because from my day job, we had the whole week off, which was amazing, but I spent the whole week working on other stuff. And so after that, my wife and I were talking about how to manage this going forward. And one of the things I said to her was like, why don't I just work a 9-to-5 like everyone else and just then have like freedom outside of work? And she said, I don't think you'd be happy doing that. And I think that is the truth. I've always, even since I was quite young, I started programming at 13 or something, because we just had computers in the house. And so ever since I was quite young, I've always been doing entrepreneurial stuff, doing stuff on the side. And so I think it's kind of just how I'm built. So my desire, like my dream, is to break away from full-time employment at some point. And then, you know, be able to go to the park at 2 o'clock and not have anyone, like not have to put up a status message that's like, BRB, I promise I'll be back soon, but I'm just gone. And so something that I'm really trying to think forward to is when the twins are, you know, three, probably starting at three, maybe a little bit earlier, but I'm in my mind, I'm thinking of them as I kind of call them like the Superman years, where dad is Superman and can do no wrong. And the only thing, you know, the only thing that the kids want is to hang out with mom and dad and just show them everything. And I don't want to miss, like, I don't want to miss those years. And so I feel like I have a clock, like it's ticking. I got to figure this out or adjust some other way, because I'm not going to miss those Superman years before they want to start, you know, hanging out with their friends and never hang out with dad.
Yeah. So practically for you, I mean, you got a full-time job during the day. What does that look like now? How do you, like, practically, how do you split up your time? And you said you've had that conversation with your wife. Is there a certain point in time where you've said, well, the next 2 years is going to look like this, and then it doesn't matter what's happened, it's going to change, and we'll switch it up and make sure we're spending time with the kids after that?
Yeah, so we haven't gotten that far out yet. Once we get past, you know, a year or so, it gets pretty vague. But currently what it looks like last night I was up till, you know, 11:30 working on side stuff. So what it looks like now is I work from home, which is a huge benefit. So I'm able to go in during the day and, you know, tickle some children. So I work from home, which is amazing. So I wake up in the mornings and I help feed, there are two of them. So I help feed one of them. And so I'm up with them from about 7 to 9 in the morning. And then I walk out here, start working. And then I am able to cut it off pretty good at like 5:30. And I'll go inside and help with another like dinner time feed, help get them ready for bed, help clean up. Then my wife and I have dinner. And then after that, so like 7:30 PM or 8, if Jennifer and I aren't hanging out together, then I get back to working on stuff, working on side stuff. And I'll also, I mean, last year I took a couple of days of PTO at certain points during the year just to like really push out some side work. And so fortunately my job is seasonal. And so the second half of the year is a lot easier. And then once we reach March, April, it gets to be pretty tough. And so I'm able to kind of flex my side stuff along with that schedule.
And then how do the weekends look though? I mean, so that's during the week. The weekends look the same?
The weekends are a little bit different. So I will typically get up and help with one in the morning, a feed in the morning, hang out. Then the kids sleep for like, you know, 2 hours in the morning. And so typically then, you know, my wife and I will do our own thing. And then when the kids wake up, sometimes we'll go, you know, we can't really go anywhere right now, but we'll try to like go out and spend some time with the kids while they're awake. And then in the afternoon, I'll do some more work again. And the same kind of goes for Sunday. You know, typically, historically, we've been going to church, but you can't, we don't want to leave the house with twins right now. We'll watch church on TV and then kind of do the same thing a Saturday, basically.
So, you know, we talked about in the beginning how hours don't necessarily, like the number of hours don't necessarily mean quality, but roughly how many hours would you say that you're able to put in with that schedule per week? Is this does it equate to like a part-time gig in addition to full-time work?
For sure, definitely. And it's tough because I'm not a freelancer, so I don't have to track it. So it's hard for me to say exactly, but it's fully 20-30 hours on the side. And especially right now, because we are at Hammerstone, we are launching our components. So we have, you know, two or three licensees on board right now. And I'm giving a talk at Laracon online in February. And so that's why I was up so late last night, because I was thinking, holy crap, I have a talk in front of thousands of people next month. I got to get my stuff together. And so there are certain times where I just like really have to buckle down and spend way too much time working.
And how do you prevent burnout? Because that's a lot of time, a lot of hours. And before you know it, you know, it gets exhausting. What do you, and you know, same for your wife, if you're working, you're either not spending as much time with her or the kids, or, you know, it sounds like you do an amazing job of balancing that, but there is always a balance. So how do you prevent burnout for either of you?
For me, I get burned out. I mean, that's the honest answer. I don't really know. So I got super burned out in October, November of last year. And just because I had been going super hard for a long time last year. And then October, November rolled around and I just couldn't do it. Like I couldn't respond to tweets. I couldn't open the editor on my side projects. I just couldn't do it. So the answer to how to prevent it, I have no idea. I got super burned out. So that was tough. And fortunately, my partners at Hammerstone are amazing about work-life balance. They have families as well. And they've done a little bit more of this than I have. And so they have a little bit more experience. But how do I prevent it for my wife? I think we've been married 7 years now. And I think one of our great strengths is we're really good at communicating. And so she's really good at telling me when she needs help. And I'm really good about asking her, what else can I do? And so one of the things that we talked about recently was having, like actually naming the time. So we call it individual pursuits. And so like some nights we decide, okay, Monday night is an individual pursuit night. She's going to go and probably watch The Crown on Netflix. And I'm going to sit at the table with headphones in and do a bunch of coding. And to have named it, it takes away from us, at least, it takes away the pressure or the guilt of, are we hanging out? Like if I sit on the couch with my computer, am I ignoring you or are you cool with it? And instead we've just said, it's an individual pursuit night. Do whatever you want. And that has helped us a whole lot, because then on nights that aren't that way, I know, well, we're spending time together. So I don't feel guilty about leaving my laptop shut because I've already decided tonight is not a side project night. So I don't have to like live with one foot in both worlds. It's either I'm working or we're hanging out. And that has helped us tremendously.
Being deliberate about that is such great advice. I need to do better at that myself. I think I kind of tend to slink off to, you know, my office and work on stuff. And before you know it, it's 11 midnight and haven't hardly talked, you know, to anyone besides coming out for dinner or whatever. So
yeah,
great advice.
And it's great for her too, because she wants to do stuff on her own. So it's not like I'm abandoning her. She's like, I want to watch The Crown and you don't like The Crown. Tonight's a perfect night to do it. It's like, oh, okay, yeah. Perfect.
So tell us a little bit about Hammerstone. We've touched on it, but wanted to understand kind of where you're at, whatever you feel comfortable or talking about without, you know, your partners here, but what it is, what your goals are, where you're at, what you kind of see the next, let's say, year looking like. And then if you had your way 5 years from now, what would that look like?
Yeah, for sure. So our thesis, our operating principle at Hammerstone is, we can afford to spend way more time thinking about particular things than an average company would. So for example, the thing that we're building right now is, it's a component and it is for Laravel Rails, and then it has front-end libraries as well. And it's the thing that you see on every analytics or pseudo analytics thing, every e-commerce, where it's like, I want to find users named Aaron, and the state that they're in is Texas, and they've purchased this thing in the past 30 days filter, like find me those people. And so the thing that we're building is that filter component. And what we'll do is it's a package. So it's not a SaaS. It's a package that as a developer, you would either Composer install if you're PHP, or you would Gem install or whatever it is if you're a Rails developer. And then that allows the application developers to provide those filters to their end users. So the thing that we're building is that package that lets you provide those complex filter interactions we handle all of that for you. So we'll handle the front end, we'll handle user validation, we'll handle the database, and we'll handle like saving the filter. So if, you know, you want to save it as like Brian's favorite customers and come back to it later, you could come back and load it back up. And so our thesis is everyone needs, not everyone, most applications need something like this, but it's really hard to build. And then when you build it, it doesn't set you apart. Your users are like, great, that's what I needed. Thanks. Now you're just like every other app. I can filter, obviously, I can filter my users. Of course, I should be allowed to do that. And so our thesis is, if that's the only thing that we focus on, we can care way more about every edge case than it would be reasonable for any company to care about, because it's not a part of their core. Like, it's not what sets them apart, but it is what sets us apart. So we've been working on that for, I probably started coding, you know, a couple years ago, honestly. And Sean and I were working on the Laravel in Vue version. And then someone came along and said, hey, we would like this in Rails. Can you build it for us in Rails? And that was always part of our vision, was to have multiple backends that interact seamlessly with multiple front ends. You pick and choose and you're off to the races. So Sean and I had this conversation of, well, this is a huge opportunity, but it's really going to throw off our timeline. Like, we're not going to release the Laravel in Vue version if we spend all our time working on a Rails and Hotwire version. And we decided to do it. So we took on this client, and we hired Colleen, our third partner. We hired her as a contractor. She's since come on as a partner. And we've spent the past year, maybe 14, 16 months working on the Rails version. And this client has been paying Colleen her day rate for that long, and we get to keep the IP.
Nice.
And so, yeah. And so we're basically kind of being, Colleen is being funded to work on this full time to build out our Rails version. And so Sean was doing the front end for a long time with Colleen, and I was off doing, you know, audience building in the Laravel world. And so where we're at now is we have two people using the Laravel version. So we've onboarded two people. We have obviously the big client in Rails and another Rails client coming on board. And so we're about to the point, we're getting early feedback. It's all good, but there's a lot of stuff that is obvious to other people that wasn't obvious to me. So we're getting a lot of feedback, and I'm fixing stuff and Sean's fixing stuff. And then at some point in the next couple of months, we'll have a proper, you know, launch and hopefully start to open the gates a little bit to the Laravel version. So the business model is you pay $1,000 a year and you get access to this, this library, and we have front end, back end. So in theory, all you have to do is just install it, and the complex query builder on the front works with the complex query builder on the back, and you're done. So that's kind of where we're at now.
So when you say you've onboarded two clients, are those paying clients or are those in beta testing?
Yeah, the deal we have with them was, these are two people that I know personally. So people that have DM'd me, and we've been talking about it all along. And so the deal we have with them is, we'll let you try it out for a couple of weeks while I like handhold you and help you get it integrated into your app. And if you decide that it is right for you, then you will pay the full license amount. And they were both like, great, that sounds good.
Sweet.
Because what I didn't want to do is give it to them for free forever, because that would suck. And the other thing I didn't want to do was make them pay up front, because our marketing documentation at this point really doesn't exist. And so it's hard for me to accurately portray to someone what they would be paying for, because we haven't focused on marketing documentation at all. And so it felt kind of unfair to make them pay up front for it, if that makes sense.
So what the model is really interesting, because it's a once a year, you're kind of paying for the package, I guess, than the service, because it's all the data is hosted on their own, in their own database.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So it sits on top of their Laravel and their Rails apps.
So what was the reason for doing it that way, as opposed to, let's say, a Heroku add-on or something along those lines?
Yeah, so we talked about a couple of different models. One model, one reason that we really like this model is we're not hosting anything. So there was the option to be like a hosted SaaS that somehow sits on top of your database or whatever and, you know, filters everything. We didn't want to have to worry about, one, owning people's data or even being able to look at it. And two, we didn't want to have to worry about staying up. Like, we're just three developers with families and full-time jobs. And so having a SaaS that we keep alive and is mission critical. Like, there are SaaSes that can go down and no one really cares. It's like, okay, well, that sucks. I'll send my invoice tomorrow. It's fine. But if your end users aren't able to use your application if we go down, then that sucks pretty bad. So that was one reason. The other reason is it's very, very, very context specific. Because only everyone's data is extremely different, of course. Even when you look at, let's say they're filtering on a yes, no column, they're filtering on a Boolean column, right? Sometimes it's nullable and they want to show the end user that it's nullable. So it's like, is this person allergic? Yes, no, I don't know. There's no data. Sometimes they don't want to show the unknowns. Sometimes they want the unknowns to also be true. So you only show true or false, but true actually means true or null. And so managing all of that in some sort of user interface or something like that sounded like a nightmare. And so our whole thing is everything is code driven. Everything is configurable by code. Every single condition, the developer of the application stays in control, not us. So we'll give you as many customizations as would be reasonable for any type of data. And then you as the developer, you get to say, on this one, show unknown. On this one, make unknowns false. And on this one, make unknowns true. And we don't have to worry about that.
So developers are your target market?
Yes.
Okay. So you, Sean, and Colleen are all three developers, right? You're all technical?
Correct.
So what does your marketing look like? Because I think that tends to be the biggest challenge for, you know, developers is the marketing side of things. What are your thoughts there?
So we have a couple of things. Sean and I originally planned on audience building, you know, with big air quotes. And what that has meant for us specifically, and this is great because we have it on, you know, we have it on our podcast that this is what we were going to try to do. And now we're here and it worked. And so it's like, okay, I promise I'm not just making this up. What we were going to try to do is release some open source packages in the Laravel community and try, for me specifically, because he's not a part of that community, for me specifically, to gain a foothold in the Laravel community, because that is our target market. So yes, it works really well for us because I'm a developer. We're trying to target developers. A lot of developers are on Twitter. So that works great for us. I've released a couple open source packages. One has done really well, and that's what I'm actually giving a talk on at Laracon. And so I've gone from, you know, 1,000 Twitter followers at the beginning of last year to, you know, 4,000 at the end of last year, just by talking a lot on Twitter about what I'm building, sharing a bunch of Laravel stuff. And so that has been if we talk about it in terms of concentric circles, that's our innermost concentric circle. That's the easiest one to reach, is people who are active on Twitter, know Aaron, follow Aaron, like Aaron. That's our inner circle. We will be able to, I think, reap the benefit of that circle for a while. And then the next question is, how do we get beyond this whole audience community building type thing? And that's where, frankly, Sean is going to be doing a lot of work, because he's done some of this before. He's had an info product business before. And I think at this point, a lot of what it's going to be is, we're going to try to target agencies to start with, because it's helpful, obviously, for someone building an app. It's more helpful for someone building 30 apps a year. So instead of, you know, trying to find 30 people, if we can find one agency that likes it, that's equivalent of 30 people. And so I think our next concentric circle is, how do we find agencies and get in with agencies? And then probably beyond that, we're looking at super broad top of the funnel SEO kind of stuff. So I've put a ton of focus into our docs to, you know, write as much as possible to give Google as many opportunities to send people to us as I can. So that's kind of how we're thinking about it at this point.
The interesting and key thing there is, as you're describing this, I'm just picturing how much time this is all taking, how long it's going to take. You know, it's the long game. It takes, you know, years.
Yeah.
it's so tempting for, technical people like us to go, I'll figure that out later. I'm going to build this cool thing. It'll be so obviously awesome that everybody will just tell each other about it because it's so great. But you're deliberately not doing that.
Yeah. And that's one of the things, frankly, that Sean has been very good about, is saying, like, it just takes the time that it takes. I've had a tough time working on this for so long without, I feel like it's an asymptote, like I'm reaching the finish line, but I'll never get there. and that's been emotionally draining for me. And Sean has been good all along, just saying it takes the time that it takes. Nobody's in any hurry. And that's been helpful. Because, like, for example, I wrote the docs as early as I possibly could, so that Google could have as much time to chew on them as it wanted. And so the docs have been up since like day one. Like, we didn't have a website because we didn't need one, but I built one and published the docs and submitted them to Google Index so that they would be there for as long as possible, so that the domain would be aged and not, like, what I didn't want to do is try to launch, register a domain, and Google say, this domain's a week old, you're in the penalty box for the next 6 months. And be like, okay, well, should have thought of that earlier. So some of this stuff, especially as indies, I feel like you just have to let it percolate. And with the open source stuff, I launched it and nobody seemed to care. And I kept going and people started to care. And then a couple of things happened and it was like, oh, Aaron has this thing that would slot in perfectly here. Now let's everybody use that. And so just having, I don't know, it's so frustrating, but just having irons in the fire and kind of biding your time and being prepared to pounce when the time comes, I feel like is really helpful.
You kind of just answered it, but how do you know if these things take a long time and you don't really know if they're going to work? It seems like everything in marketing is the long game, other than gimmicks. How do you know that what you're doing is worth your time and that you shouldn't be doing something else instead?
I don't. I mean, I wish I had you. Now you've asked me two really good questions that I have zero answers for. I don't. And so I'm actually, have you heard of, Daniel Vassallo, the good parts of AWS. He's the guy who used to work at Amazon, quit his job. Now he's an indie maker and, you know, makes a bajillion dollars. One of the things that he talks about all the time is small bets instead of going all in on one thing. And I think that has influenced my thinking a little bit, in that we don't know what's going to work. And so instead of putting all of our eggs in, for example, the SEO basket and just really hoping that it pays off eventually, we have SEO, we have open source, we have Twitter community, we have the podcast. And so we're putting a little bit of effort into all of those things. And I think knowing that some of them aren't going to hit, I think that's the case. Obviously, I want them all to hit. But we're just kind of like pushing each one forward a little bit as we go. And let's say in a year, SEO is our primary thing. Well, we wouldn't have known that. And honestly, we wouldn't have gotten off the ground without the community or the audience building thing. And so I don't know. And what Daniel always says is, because the world is, like, talk about input output, because the world is so random, You just have to try a bunch of things. Knowing a bunch will fail, but the one that works, you couldn't have known that up front. So you shouldn't feel bad about trying four things if one of them ends up working.
But I think what's really helpful though, right? What's helpful for Aaron is that you guys have got clients, existing clients that are using your product. And I think that's where a trap that a lot of us indie makers fall into is I spent 2 years building remote time without actually speaking to any existing freelancers to actually use the product. So, I mean, you already know by speaking to existing clients, what is the value proposition here? What is the thing that you value most of our product? And then it's fairly easy to turn that into some sort of copy or marketing, whatever form that may take. Yeah. So I think that's really helpful from your end.
It's incredibly helpful because one of the things you see a lot on, let's say, startups for the rest of us or indie hackers or something is developers building in a cave for a long time. And I personally feel like I've kind of been doing that. I also have very strong vision about what this should be, but we have pretty solid proof with, you know, this client that's paying us to build this thing, with the number of people who DM us and say, can I use this thing? We're getting good input that this is a pain that people are feeling. Now, the question is the solution I've been building, does it fix that pain? But at least we're not operating in a world where people are hearing about all of this stuff and nobody is contacting us. Like, this client's paid Colleen, I won't say how much, but a lot, like a full-time developer salary to build this. And so we have great signal that this is painful and worth pursuing.
Makes sense. Sounds like the other thing you were saying is, it's a little cliche, but there is no silver bullet in marketing. It's more about compound interest. Like, the things build on each other, more like a flywheel, builds on each other, gets better and better over time as you continue to add to it. But you've got to start early on because, like a flywheel, you know, it's really hard to get going. You have to push really, really hard just to get any movement. But once it gets going, it's hard to stop. And that's why you want to kind of get started early. So that was super helpful for me as a reminder. You know, to not just build something and hope it takes off or figure it out later, but, you know, be deliberate about at least what you want to try early on to give it time to bake.
Yeah. 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 And it's great. Like I said, it's great for us because it's developers, developers, developers. For you, when you're like going for real estate or whatever, it's like the Twitter thing. I don't know if that works. I mean, real estate Twitter is definitely a thing, but I'm not a part of that community, so I don't know how that works. But, you know, freelancers are all over Twitter. So that's another. Probably a prime audience, but it's so different for every app and for every person, and everyone's appetite for building in public is going to be different as well. It's just hard to say.
Well, I want to dig into the Twitter concept a little bit more. You kind of casually mentioned that you grew 400% in 1 year, your Twitter following. So yeah. what types of things are you sharing? Is it just like stuff that's interesting as you go? Are you deliberately timing things or sharing things or curating things? Or how does that look for you?
Yeah, I actually have pretty strong opinions on that. So I decided in March of 2021, you know, there's no such thing as time anymore. But in March of 2021, I decided to take Twitter seriously and to put in an effort to grow my following. And so the things that I decided to change were, one, tweet a lot more. So that's probably been my number one thing, is I just tweet a lot more. I used to tweet once a week. And now I probably tweet, retweets included, maybe a couple times a day. So that was my big one. The second thing that I probably focus on and care about is staying on pretty on message. Now, there are people who will, if it's not about Laravel, don't tweet at all. That's not quite me. I'm... you know, normal distribution. I'm mostly Laravel, a little bit of other stuff. But what I don't tweet about is if I had a bad experience at the grocery store and I'm frustrated, I don't share that because, like, and please, everyone, this worked for me. I have no idea if it'll work for you, and your life is your own. But I don't like when I am following people and they complain that someone at the airline was rude to them. I do not care even 1%. I care 0% about somebody's negative customer service interaction. And so I don't tweet about those kind of things. I tweet about Laravel and things that I think Laravel people would find interesting. So that's the that's the little bit outside the normal distribution. Is sometimes I tweet about robots. Sometimes I tweet about super cool, interesting math things, which, you know, math things are cool and interesting. So that has been, that's kind of been the way that I have shaped my, my brand on Twitter is when you follow me. And another thing is I don't tweet memes about software development. And I don't tweet bait like, oh, is being a front-end coder, are you really a coder? It's like, okay, that works. Like, that works. That gets a lot of engagement. But yeah. I find it super gimmicky. And you end up with people following you that are just there for like hot takes and memes. And that's not helpful for me. Like, I want to have conversations with Laravel developers. And I want to make friends with Laravel developers. I don't want 50,000 people following me because I tweet funny memes about SaaS. And that is a strategy that people follow. And I assume that it works well for them. I've seen the numbers and it works great in terms of numbers. I have no idea what it means in terms of like actual engagement. And so for me, I feel like it's less audience building, or it straddles the line between audience building and networking, because it's less, I want everyone to follow me, and more, I want to be a part of this community and have conversations with these people. And that, I mean, that's worked really well for me. So my three rules are, one, I stay positive. I encourage, like, that goes into the customer service thing. But like, if I see other people doing something awesome in the Laravel community, I like quote tweet it, or I'll, you know, write my own tweet and say, look at this cool thing that they just released. Way to go. That totally rules. I want to use it. The other thing is, I like share what I'm working on. So people like to follow, people that are in motion. And so anytime I'm working on something and I think, this is kind of interesting, I'll share it, because people like to share or like to follow along with people that are in motion. A lot of people want to be doing stuff, and because of life, they can't. And so when they see other people doing things, they're like, yes, that's awesome. I want to follow along. And so I have encourage other people, be positive, and share what you're working on. So the encourage other people and be positive kind of go together. But I feel like it's important to say not to encourage other people. So I want to bring like a spotlight on other people wherever I can. So it's not all just about me. So those are kind of my rules.
So what I'm hearing you saying is that it's a lot more about relationship forming than just for the sake of building audiences that don't really mean anything personally, right?
Yes.
And that kind of brings me to the question around, you mentioned, it sounds like you've got a fairly good relationships with your partners or co-founders or whatever label you want to put on them. Mm-hmm. What was your thinking going into that? Because I think a lot of us indie makers, we start off in our cave and we think we're going to build this thing, and you spend a good couple of years, and the whole thing of co-founders is a little bit scary in terms of risk, you know, because of all the stories that you hear about, that's what most of the time breaks things apart. How was your thinking going into that? I'm going to build, at the end of the day, what's a business, and it's going to generate revenue, and you're going to have to share that some way. Yeah. And there's equity discussions and all those things. Can you share a little bit about your process of thinking of that?
Yeah, for sure. So Sean and I met, I think in 2012 at a conference that Amy Hoy used to put on, called Bacon Biz Conf. It's no longer a thing, but back in 2012, it was like MicroConf, but probably definitely smaller. So Sean and I met there, and we've been internet friends ever since. And so there's like a small Slack group of people that met at that conference and have met other people at other conferences and like know this person from here. And so there's like this little Slack group of us. And we had a retreat in, I think it was 2018, so the before times, it might have been 2019. We had a retreat in DC and Colleen was there because she knew somebody else in the group and they were local to DC and showed up. And so the concept of taking on partners is scary. I wouldn't have done it maybe, or would have thought a lot harder about it if I hadn't known Sean for almost what now 10 years. And so one of the conversations that Sean and I had up front was like, okay, let's do this 50-50. Makes perfect sense. He does front end, I do back end. We'll figure it out as we go. And we just had a handshake deal. Because we agreed that it would be more important to like maintain our friendship than get in a fight over a component. And at that point it was different, right? At that point it was really low stakes. It was, we haven't built anything.
Yes.
There's no money. We're just friends and we want to see if this thing works. And so that at that point it was low stakes. And so I don't want to get the cart ahead of the horse and like lawyer up against my friend for a thing that doesn't exist. This is not legal advice. Do whatever you want. So then we decided to bring on Colleen and it was the same kind of deal. It was like, okay, we've known Colleen 3 or 4 years. We worked with her on the client for about a year before we had the conversation about, do you want to come in and own the Rails part of our business? And at that point, it got a little more complicated because now there are three people. Now there is money, there is momentum, there is a product. And so what we've done is, and we haven't finished it yet, but we have, we agreed in principle on what we thought was important and what we were going to do going forward. And now, hopefully in the next month or two, we're going to meet up in person with an attorney and get an operating agreement to take what we agreed on in principle and put it into a binding contract. Because now we're at the point where, heaven forbid, somebody dies, what happens to that part of the equity? And like, those are real adult conversations that we need to have, because this is no longer just a couple of doofuses thinking about an idea. Like, this is a proper business with money in the bank and a huge client and more clients. And so that was kind of the evolution. A lot of people will say, you know, you don't need anything. You need a handshake. Just as many will say, you need everything, like put everything into a contract. I don't know. I'm kind of in the middle, and it depends on how well you know the people you're working with. One thing that we did that I think is extremely interesting is if we reach an impasse, something that the three of us like are fighting on and can't decide, we've written in our, you know, preliminary operating agreement that we will submit it to a panel of our friends. So we'll submit it to a panel of these three other people that are in, like, we've known for 10 years. And each of us kind of picked one to be like their representative or whatever. Oh, nice. And we'll submit it to this panel of our friends that we all know, love, and trust, and they'll help us, you know, figure it out. And so instead of like, we're at an impasse, we need to go to arbitration, the first step is we'll submit it to this panel. And if they can figure it out, we'll go with what they say because we trust them. That's insane. I don't know if that's a good idea.
Sounds good to me.
It seemed great to us.
Yeah, smart. Man, there have been so many great topics that we've gone over. I don't even know what we're going to call this episode, but it's covered everything from being an indie parent to bootstrapping to partners, to everything. It's been awesome.
Yeah, this has been great. I listen to y'all all the time and it's fun like be here, talk. Yeah, I love your show. I've listened to the whole thing. When I first, I think one of you mentioned it on Indie Hackers and I was like, ooh, another show. So I went and started at the you know, episode one, and I'm fully caught up. So being able to talk back to you now is a whole lot of fun. So thanks for having me.
It's funny. I was thinking about, the kind of network of podcasts out there, and I feel like we're just the noobs still, but you've got, you remember back, well, maybe I'm dating myself, back in the day when like GeoCities was a thing, there were at the bottom of your page, you could put a web ring that would be like a linked list of other cool sites that you liked. It's like becoming this web ring of GeoCities web ring of podcasts. We've got you here, and you've got your Hammerstone podcast. You've also got Sean and Colleen. Colleen's on Software Social. You just talked to Matt, who's on Out of Beta. You know, it's just like everybody's connected. It's such a small world. It's fun to be part of.
It's so fun. I love it.
Appreciate you coming on. I would love to hear from you in closing. A couple of things. I love reading. Like, reading's my drug of choice, I guess, for relaxing. What is your favorite book, one that you would recommend? And then your favorite podcast, aside from Indie Dads, of course. You know, maybe your second favorite podcast.
Okay, sure. Thank
you. your favorite person to follow on Twitter, who you would recommend that we all follow.
Ooh, wow. Okay. Let's see. Favorite book is going to be tough because I haven't been reading a lot recently. So I think one of my all-time favorites is a book called In Praise of Slowness. Kind of an odd choice. You know, I could pick Atomic Habits, but I feel like everybody's picked that. Also, I haven't read it. In Praise of Slowness is great because it challenges the everything must be faster all the time concept. It has a bit of a new age veil on it, but if you can read through that, I found it to be challenging and helpful to take things slower. And by going slower, you can do them better. So that would probably be one of the back catalog favorite books. Other question was podcasts.
Yeah. Favorite podcast.
So I will say, I'm going to leave out several that everyone else would probably say. Lots of good ones. Indie Hackers, Startups for the Rest of Us. I'm going to leave all those out. Makers.dev. Have you heard of this one? Makers.dev is great. It is these two developers, Chris and Christian, and they just get on and just, they just bebop. They just have so much fun. Christian is unbridled enthusiasm. Chris is like getting his PhD in machine learning. And so they balance each other out really well. And it's highly, highly recommended. Makers.dev.
Awesome.
And then the last one was what? Oh, who to follow on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't follow Daniel Vassallo, I would recommend that. I feel like a lot of people do. And so I will say the other one is Matt Wensing, the guy that does Summit, has that podcast you mentioned, and came and talked to me about being a dad. I really like following Matt on Twitter.
Yeah. Matt's funny. His enthusiasm is, to me, motivating because it's, you know, he's so excited about everything that he works on and does. So,
and he's ruthlessly practical. Like, he's ruthlessly practical. And I love that so much. So I recommend him.
Awesome. Well, the thing that we, since you've listened to the podcast, you know that the thing we always end with is a good dad joke.
Yeah,
so let's, why don't you hit us with your best dad joke?
Well, a dad joke, Brian, that those would debate if whether they're good or not. I think we'll leave that up to the audience. But no, I don't want to put Aaron under any pressure. So Aaron, you get to go first.
Thanks. okay, so thank you for warning me that I was going to be participating in this because I would have felt very nervous otherwise. All right. So dad joke. Vin Diesel only eats two meals a day. They are Break Fast and Break Furious. It's pretty bad, right?
That's good.
Oh, man. I'm going to look forward to telling these to my kids.
I'm not sure if mine would get that one. They might have to watch the movie first, and then I'll do it in the credits at the end. Don't you hate it when people answer their own questions? I do.
Nice. Well done, Brian.
So bad.
I slipped mine right in there.
Yeah, so I'm. It may not look it, but I love eating food. So I've actually so much so that I've given my stomach a name, and I've called it Budapest. Do you know why? Because it's the capital of Hungary.
That one's good.
I knew the direction you were going. I didn't know where it was going to land. It was pretty good.
Yeah, that's a good one. I should link to it, but on Twitter, somebody messaged us. I apologize for not remembering who this was, but a database of dad jokes that somebody had created on the side as like a passion project. So there's all kinds of good stuff in there. I'll have to link to it in the show notes because that deserves some attention. Cool. Well, thanks for being on with us. This has been super fun. Really appreciate it. As you know, our first guest, I'd say if all of our guests are half as fun as you've been, then we'll be doing this for a long time. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks again. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on, Aaron.
Yeah. Good luck with Hammerstone, and we'll keep an eye on the podcast and listen in and see how that's going, and we'll be rooting for you.
Awesome. Talk to y'all soon.
All right. See ya.
Cool, James. Cheers. If you enjoyed this episode and you want an easy way to support us, we'd love it if you reviewed this podcast on whichever platform you're using to tune in. If you'd like to ask a question, you can send us an email to hello@indiedads.com or message us directly on Twitter. You can also find us at indiedads.com, where you can see show notes, links to our Twitter profiles, and product websites. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.